Hello, everyone. It's Shiashi here. Before we get into today's story, I wanted to talk to you all for a quick minute about my cousin, Brittany Littledave. We just came upon the 6-month mark into her disappearance. You know, I've said this many times, but I never really understood how hard it is to truly keep your loved one at the forefront of missing person reports until it's actually your loved one. Her sister has not stopped calling hospitals, shelters, detectives. She has not stopped her public cries for help. Brittany, if you're out there and by some miracle are listening to this, please, please know that you are loved, you are missed, and your family will never stop looking for you. If you have any information regarding the disappearance of Brittany Littledave, please call the Fresno Police Department at 559-621-7000. Now back to the story. Pepita Redhair was 27 years old when she left her home in New Mexico to visit her boyfriend living just 2 hours away in Albuquerque in March 2020. A member of the Navajo Nation, Pepita was close to her family and was always responsive when it came to phone calls and texts. When Pepita stopped responding to messages 3 days after she arrived in Albuquerque, her family knew immediately something was terribly wrong. This is the story of Pepita Redhair.
Hey guys, this is Ash.
This is Shiashi.
This is Maggie, and you're listening to We Are Resilient.
And today is our 10th full episode recording.
It's crazy. We were just talking about how quickly this came, and like it seems like we just started, but we've been doing it for 4 months.
It's only 4 months. Well, Ash was saying she feels like we've been doing it forever.
It's been a year, right?
Well, it's because it's taken up so much of our time because, you know, a lot of the researching and things that we do, it takes a lot of our time.
Yeah.
It was just crazy to think that, you know, aside from like the little mini episodes, that we're like 10 full episodes in and to see how far we've gotten. So I'm pretty proud of this. Look at us.
We're actually doing it.
For our listeners, we know that our episodes come out bi-weekly. So by the time you guys hear this and what we're about to talk about, I guess time-wise would be 2 weeks ago. But Maggie, Ash, and I went to a sunrise prayer ceremony here on the Koala Boundary. It was for an event called Seven Peaks for Seven Sisters. It's in recognition of seven Indigenous women who have gone missing in Indian Country. So I'm going to tell you guys just a little bit about it. It kicked off with a 3-day run that visited the seven peaks throughout the occupied Kumeyaay ancestral homelands in San Diego County, California. Each peak was dedicated to a missing sister, who is Jessica Alva, Rose Downwind, who we covered in Episode 8, Khadija Britton, Marlene Joletta McGee, Kiara Henry, Nicole Smith, and Selena Not Afraid, who we also covered in Episode 2. And Ash, I just want to say, the mini you did on Selena's older sister, Tristan, was awesome. And if you haven't listened to it yet, you totally should, because the case is bananas. I don't want to kind of give it away if no one's heard it yet, but basically around Tristan Gray is her case. There's evidence, there's witness statements, but her case is still unsolved.
And there's footage.
And footage. How crazy is that?
And the guy that hit her called 911. Him and his mother called 911, but because he feared for his life, he was justified in leaving the scene. So I just don't understand where the justice was.
What did he fear?
I think he
How do you fear for your own life?
I think he feared of the repercussions of what had happened. How his life was going to change after what he did.
Yeah, but if that's the reasoning, then we could all do something wrong.
But that's not direct fearing for your life. I would assume that's like immediate danger. So I was just blown away. I was like, what was he fearing from? He's the one that hit her. But even with all this, her case is still technically unsolved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you guys go back and listen to episode 2, Selena's family has experienced an extreme amount of loss. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ash was just kind of telling us one thing after another. And this was before we even got fully into Selena's story. So just to hear that about Tristan Gray and kind of get a better feel of what her story was, that was really... It was pretty shocking, I would say. So basically the event, the prayer ceremony we attended this morning was to honor these families and these missing and murdered Indigenous women. And again, I gotta say, I'm pretty proud of this because if our 6 a.m. text thread discussion is any indication, we are not mourning people. We were questioning our life decisions this morning. And
at 6:15 a.m.
At 6:15 a.m.
Yeah. I got up and the first thing I did was look at the temperature and I said, guys, it's 23 degrees.
But we made it. We did it. And I'm glad that we went. How do you guys feel about attending the ceremony? What's the first for us?
It's kind of sad, honestly, that there wasn't more participation. There was only, what, 13 of us there, including three of the organizers.
Yeah.
And the organizers were elderly women that are kind of just like out on their own doing it. So I thought that was really awesome, that it's a different generation. Because when we're reading the stories and stuff now, like a lot of the stuff we see is families or younger people trying to bring awareness. So seeing people from the older generation or women from the older generation kind of trying to make awareness for it was really great.
Yeah, they shared their stories of, you know, local stories. And they shared one story of how they went out and helped search for one young woman at one point.
Mm-hmm.
How they went out into the woods and searched for her. And they
thought, their friend, right?
Yeah, it was one of their friends, and they thought that the father had something to do with it. And from what I remember, they haven't found her, right?
They never found her body.
Gosh. And there was also a moment when we were standing out there, it was 23 degrees, and it was so cold.
It was very cold.
It was, I mean, we stood out there for like an hour and a half, but we were out there in this field, and I thought about all the stories that we shared from Montana and how those young women died from hypothermia. And I mean, just being out there for an hour and a half, it was so cold. It was miserable. I couldn't imagine someone laying in a field for weeks or days, even hours, and feeling that cold and that.
Yeah, and we were mostly miserable. Properly dressed.
Yeah,
yeah. We barely made the hour.
Yeah.
You know.
So that was kind of like a realization. Mm-hmm. It kind of puts it in perspective.
You know, like hypothermia does happen and has happened to some of these women, but I guess our big issue is that that's just the resounding result of like a majority of the cases that we see when there's so many other factors that come into it. How did she get there to be in the first place?
Right.
You know, there's just a lot of questions there. And for me, I learned a lot in terms of the discussion they had about the MMIW for the Eastern Band. And what I thought was interesting is that I think from the chief's post, we saw that there was about 17 or 18 MMIWs here.
Yeah.
And they mentioned about 25.
They even mentioned me, too. Yeah,
they did. And so one of the things that we've all struggled with is being able to find enough information to do these stories justice and to adequately tell these stories. And again, that's why we started doing the mini episodes, because there's just not a lot of information out there. So it really had me thinking, and I didn't really realize until this prayer ceremony that not every family wants to relive or rehash the tragic circumstances of their loved one. You know, I've been so moving forward on remembering who these women are and telling their stories and just hoping that this awareness will change perceptions and things like that. It just didn't occur to me that whether it happened years ago or decades ago, some families just want to move on. And because there's not a lot of information about the MMIW here on the Qualla boundary, we are having to be reliant on families to be able to open up to tell us the stories.
Well, that's like, you know, we've gotten a lot of requests to cover local cases, but that was my hesitation, is that, you know, while one family member may want to share the story, like particularly the one from Robbinsville that was my neighbor, like she has living children still. So I feel like, you know, that is a concern too, that we really have to be cautious of how we're telling these stories and if it's okay with the family. But I think a lot of the cases that we've covered so far, the family has been really, really active in the movement and just, you know, not only promoting their family member's case, but also other cases.
Yeah. I don't want to leave anybody out, but I think for me, it's just coming to the understanding that some families just may want to leave things alone and just remember their loved one.
I mean, can you imagine how tragic it would be to have to, like, I mean, you want to remember your loved one, but to remember them in such a way all the time.
Have to keep reliving that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you still just don't know what happened. Yeah. So you're reliving it, but there's no solution here. There's no closure. So I think that was a really big takeaway for me from this morning. But I thought it was really powerful to see, you know, these women here. And, you know, they're really trying to get things going here on the boundary. And I was really happy that we could be there. You know, we managed to get up. Yeah. We managed to get up and make it. You know, I'll do a biscuit run for them ladies any day they want me to. So.
Yeah, and one of my friends commented on a post. Well, I sent it to him, and he was like, "No way, that's way too early." And I said, "You can't care about a cause only when it's convenient." And I think that's absolutely true. And
yeah, that's very true.
Have to remember.
Well, and you mentioned that before about how people are really driven when it's like the day of awareness. This is something we need to be cognizant of and aware of all the time.
Yeah,
not just when it's
convenient.
Popular, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We are working on stories for the EBCI. A lot of these cases, the information just isn't there. We just want to raise awareness, if anything. So saying her name isn't a catchphrase. We just want people to remember these women and be reminded that these women are people who matter and were and are still loved to this day. So I'm going to plug this in here real fast, guys. It's just if you have any information you would like to share, articles, or if you could just point us in any direction about any of the MMIW for BBCI, you can send us a message on our social media at We Are Resilient or email us at wearresilientpod@gmail.com. So I did want to provide a quick update that I received from a listener. If you've been following the pod, we did a mini episode back on Danielle Brady, who was a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. And again, we've said it like a number of times, but it's a tribe that Maggie, Osh, and I are a part of. It was an updated list of charges against Billy Jack Hicks that I didn't find in my initial research. Along with the initial charge of assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill and inflict serious injury, the details listed, he was also charged with, as of January 29th, 2021, murder, possession of a firearm by a felon, and this is what got me, murder of an unborn child.
Oh, wow.
Danielle was pregnant at the time of her death.
He hasn't been to trial yet.
No, he's still awaiting trial, as far as I know.
That just adds to the sadness of her story.
Just gave me chills. Because it's just, it's,
I don't know why I always say this. I never understand why people do what they do. But why would you harm your own unborn child? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. And I know we can't.
That's why it's just a senseless act.
No, it truly is.
Glad that a listener sent that in.
Was it a family member?
You know, I don't know. They just sent in and said this is kind of the updated information about his charges. I was at a loss for words because I didn't find that in my initial research that she was pregnant when she died.
Either way, that's two lives lost.
Yeah.
But that being said, I want to shift us into today's story. So I came across this name as I was researching other cases. And I don't know if this happens to you guys, but sometimes in doing research or trying to find a story, I find another story. Then you have to find out more about it. Then you go into this big rabbit hole of this story. Then you find like there's like five other stories that are similar to it. It's really hard.
From the same town. Have you guys noticed that?
Yeah.
Or like the same, you know, counties or areas.
And the circumstances are like eerie similar. Like, again, we ran into that with Selena Not Afraid because there was a girl under the same circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just taken by this story. And so I wanted to cover it. And so today we're going to talk about the disappearance of Pepita Madeline Redhair. Pepita was a 27-year-old member of the Navajo Nation living in New Mexico at the time of her disappearance. She was born on August 4th, 1992, and had dreams of becoming an engineer. And she was described as someone who loved to skateboard and draw. She liked to talk to people and cook. So right off the bat, she sounds super cool. Definitely a lot cooler than me.
And she has a cool name.
That is a cool name. Yeah. Pepita right here. I know Maggie had talked about the Navajo Nation during the episode about Miss Ella Mae Begay. But, you know, in keeping with tradition and what we do here, we like to try and educate a little bit about the tribes that we're talking about. So I'm just going to add a little more to it because, again, I really went down a rabbit hole as I was researching the story in the area where it takes place. We know that the Navajo Nation is the largest Native American tribe in the United States. But what I didn't know was that roughly one third of the tribe lives in New Mexico. And I do have family that lives in New Mexico and they listen. So if you're listening, hey, say hi to them, guys.
Hey, guys.
That was Osh.
She-yo.
So as I went to the website, newmexico.org, and found some really interesting information. And that includes the infamous Long Walk in 1860. Now, I'll be honest, I've never heard of this, but you guys can probably infer from the Long Walk what that is. And it's basically
a removal.
Yeah.
When I read this, I was a little bit embarrassed because there's still so much Native American history. I just don't know. You know, I mentioned in the Ashley Aldridge case about Omaha, and I didn't know that was a tribe. I don't know why I didn't.
I think we're just doing research. I think we're all just learning a lot, too.
Yeah.
Learning so much about the tribes.
Yeah.
So I found this really great site, and I'm going to link it in the show notes, but it broke it down, the Long Walk, in a very, very clear way for someone like me to understand. So the traditional homelands of the Navajo are marked by four sacred mountains that stretch across modern-day Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona. In the mid-1800s, the United States emerged as a nation driven to expand its territory west of the Mississippi. We know Spain controlled much of that land that today is known as the southwestern United States and Mexico. So following the Mexican-American War and the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, the United States was poised to take more lands and increase settlement in the Southwest. Like many Native nations, the Navajo signed treaties as well as fought against American efforts to create pathways from the East to California. Basically, the Navajo mounted a campaigns of resistance in order to remain in their homelands, but were eventually outnumbered and with few choices. Thousands of Navajo surrendered and were forced to march between 250 and 450 miles to the Bosque Redondo Reservation, which is basically Fort Sumner in New Mexico. While intended to be a reservation, Bosque Redondo functioned as an internment camp.
Well, a lot of the Navajo reservation now is on really desolate lands. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it makes you wonder kind of what the lands they were in before they were removed were like. I'm sure they were, you know, they had built them over the years and it wasn't as bad as it is now.
Like, I guess it's that notion, like, yeah, the whole, like, savage notion and the way of life is just that different, but it worked. And, you know, if they were living and content, then...
But, you know, in Ella Mae's story, we talked about how she had finally had power in her house for the first time as an elderly adult.
And it's sad that we live in America, but we still have people that live in third world conditions.
But it makes you wonder how much of that now was affected by the removal. Because they probably had, like, you know, camps and lands built.
Ways to function and live. That's a really good point. Or how much the land was kind of destroyed.
Yeah.
In that process. U.S. stationed soldiers there at the Bosque Redondo internment camp to make sure that the Navajo could not leave. Again, when I say internment camp, think prison camp, think starvation, diseases, rape, murder, all at the hands of the government that was trying to take land that did not belong to them. So from the beginning, the plan was to force the Navajo to adopt to white American culture values. However, many Navajo resisted cultural assimilation and would continue to fight until they were allowed to return home. Now, this camp lasted for about 4 years when the government relented and returned the Navajo back to their homeland. The Navajos and the U.S. government signed a treaty of 1868, creating the basis for relations still honored today. So when the treaty was signed, I had read that a line of the Navajo people had formed, and it was like miles and miles long because they were ready to go back home. And they had cleansing ceremonies that were conducted to help remove the taint of the foreign from their spirits, minds, and bodies. There's just a lot of information out there. And I think, you know, MMIW and awareness is obviously our number one goal here. But I think the more we go into it, the more we realize, like, there's a lot of information that people just don't know that can contribute to how Native Americans and Indigenous people are viewed, you know, especially when we talk about historical trauma and generational trauma and boarding schools and kind of putting those things in perspective for people.
And I think that's kind of one of our goals, too, is just to bring awareness about Native people in general. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not historians. We don't.
No. We Google.
Yeah. We do our own research. We have people that we can ask. Yeah. But, you know, that's bring awareness to what Native people are and who we are.
Well, and that's why we start talking about the tribes, because there's so many. Yeah. And I think people really kind of just, you know, dwindle us down to, like, Navajo or Sioux or Cherokee. And there's, what, over 500 federally recognized tribes. There's so many. Speaking of tribes, New Mexico does have 23 tribes. However, we're headed to the Crown Point community, located in the northwestern region of New Mexico and in the mid-southern part of the checkerboard area.
Is it close to, like, a major city?
From what I read, it's about a two-hour drive from Albuquerque. And it's the Crown Point community where our story begins. So Pepita Redhair lived in the Crown Point community with her mother, Anita. At 27 years old, she had already been involved in a very tumultuous relationship with her boyfriend, Nicholas K., who is also referred to as Nicholas Real. And it was a relationship that her family alleges was extremely abusive. We keep running into this in these stories about intimate partner violence and how this comes at the hands of people that were close to them. So the last time Pepita's mother, Anita, saw her was on March 24th, 2020, when she was traveling with Pepita and two other family members to take her to visit her boyfriend in Albuquerque. By all accounts, and from what I read, Pepita was known for being very responsive to text messages. And again, we hear this a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's the younger generation.
Yeah.
Not with other phones.
She was very responsive, especially with messages from her mother. Even the days prior to her disappearance, her family was receiving photos from her. She was smiling and enjoying the Sandia Mountains, which I Googled again and found that those are the most visited mountains in New Mexico, and they're absolutely beautiful. So Anita said the last time she spoke with Pepita in person was when she was dropping her off. She gave her a hug. They said goodbye. And after the drop off, it was normal. Texts were normal. 3 days went by. And then on March 27th, it was silence. So Anita tried calling, tried texting, and was quoted saying that her intuition right away told her something was wrong. Again, how many times have we read stories where mothers or family members know something is wrong? They just know in their gut. We know our people.
And if there was already a history, like you said, then she was probably worried about leaving her there. to begin with.
That's true. I hate reading when it's not taken seriously or it's brushed off. You know, we talked about that in the Misty case. So after several days of trying to reach Pepita, she said that someone had finally texted her back, claiming they didn't know who Pepita was and that they had bought the phone from someone but didn't state who. So it was in that moment she filed a missing persons report. And from my understanding, this was done on March 30th. So this was about, what, 5 days?
Six days later.
So, not much is said between the time, between the next few weeks afterwards. What I found was that Pepita's boyfriend, Nicholas, actually filed his own missing persons report on April 19th. And when he did it, he explained what he said happened during that time in March when Pepita came to visit him. So, according to the police report, he said that he and Pepita went out for a drink on the night of March 26th. March 26th, 2 days after she arrived. He said that they later argued and Pepita walked out. And the next day, Nicholas said he received a text from Pepita saying she was with another man. And he guessed it might have been a man they had met while they were out the night before. So what he's saying is they went out for a drink one night and then they got to an argument. She left. And then the next day she's like, I'm with this other man.
That's okay.
So was that's the his family story. Was he communicating with the family at all?
What I read, it doesn't sound like it, because Anita was quoted saying that she had went to Albuquerque to collect Pepita's things in May, and after that, she hasn't talked or heard from him since. But she remained suspicious of him because of the history of domestic violence, but the fact that, you know, I guess theoretically he was the last person to see her.
But if she called him and said, I'm with another man, why would he file a missing person report? She left him.
You ask great questions. Her boyfriend, the last person to see her, had a brief interview with investigators, according to her family members. They said the department told them police could not activate a warrant for his arrest due to pandemic restrictions. Officers mentioned visiting her home many times to respond to reports of domestic violence, but the violent reality of her life was evoked by police in a dismissive and disrespectful way. They said that she was hospitalized about a week before she went missing with head contusions. And there was a couple articles I found, and I have a slew of them that are going to be in the show notes, because what the hard part is about this, and you guys know, is trying to piece together details, because one news article will have stuff, another news article will have like a little tiny bit from, you know, something else that happened. So it's just trying to piece it together. I did read that she was hospitalized a week before.
I mean, you don't have any more information on that, just kind of what her injuries were.
Yep. And if this was the case, my gut first, I'd be like, no, I'm not driving you to see this man. Because if I thought that her boyfriend put her in the hospital with head contusions, that wouldn't be my, I don't think I would do that. But when you see people in these toxic relationships, or if you've been in one, you can't really talk them out of what they're doing. You know, it's something that I read, they have to come to the realization on their own. Otherwise, you're just another person who isn't listening or trying to understand what they feel. So it's a difficult place to be in, and I can tell you from experience, watching a family member kind of go down the sinkhole, being in an abusive relationship, and there's nothing you can do or say to stop it, or, you know, you want to be like, you know, you deserve better, they just don't hear you. So it's hard, and, you know, I don't know what was going on in that time. It's not clear. All I know is that they're adamant that the relationship was extremely abusive. In an email statement from the Albuquerque Police Department, they said they were aware of a domestic history with the boyfriend and are checking into it. And they also noted that Pepita's case had gone cold. However, they are currently working on some new leads, and a detective is assigned to the case. But they did note that there are no indications of foul play at this time.
I never understand that. When someone goes missing and no one can find them or contact them, how is there no foul play? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
They're just up and vanished?
I mean, maybe a severe debt or, like, you know,
there's, like, indicators there to say that they have something to run from.
A missing person with no contact to anyone that loves them, it has to be foul play of some sort. Like, what other explanation would it be?
You need to go back to that detective school you said you were going to go to get your degree so we can come on here as our expert. Because you're right, it doesn't make sense. And again, we know our people. We know if something's not right or this isn't typical behavior for them. And again, I mentioned it earlier, but this takes me back to Misty's case because I was reading how Pepita's sister, Shelda, would like to see change in how law enforcement gets information and records from family. She said that Pepita's background was immediately questioned by reporting officers, which she argues led to discrimination.
Did she have a history of substance abuse?
It didn't say, but this quote from her sister said, just because you have a police record and you go ask for help, they're like, oh, she's not calling. Oh, she's just a drug addict. Oh, they smoke meth. You know, it's a stereotype. It's like we're being judged before they even get to know you or get to know that person. That's the hard part, to say my sister is missing and hear that.
Well, and we talked about in Misty's episode how I hope that no one ever turns to drugs or, you know, something that could harm themselves. But a lot of times these people have reasons for why they turn to things like this. And a lot of it is a traumatic childhood or history. So, I mean, she's right. They deserve just as much attention as someone who doesn't use or someone who doesn't have a background with the police.
And I think, too, that as Native people, sometimes we don't know how to deal with generational trauma or trauma in our everyday lives. And so one way that we try to cope with things is to joke about it. Mm-hmm. We joke about something. And then sometimes when you get so deep into your depressive state that it's too late to find help, or it's too hard to find help, or I don't know. But joking about something doesn't help all the time. And so I think addressing the issue of finding help, reaching out, getting help before you get too deep down this hole that you turn to drugs and drugs are the only way to cope. And then you get addicted. And like you said, it's a stigma. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, she's just on drugs.
I mean, so many of the stories, just like your cousin Brittany, all of her stuff was kind of dismissed based off of her history of kind of like moving around and, oh, she's done this before. Yeah, but this time
she's had a drug issue too.
Yeah, but this time it's completely different because no one's heard from her for months.
Months of silence.
Yeah.
And, you know, and again, you know, this, we've covered this in other episodes about how people who have been on drugs or facing addiction kind of get dismissed. And whether or not they have a problem with addiction or not is irrelevant. They're missing.
It's still somebody, somebody.
It's still somebody, somebody. They're missing. To feel like that you're trying to report your sister missing and that it's being that dismissive, or like in Misty's case, you know, the family was adamant and advocating and wanting to get her help. And
we're asking for help. That's what these families are doing, too. They're asking for help. Mm-hmm. And no one's listening.
Well, it's been nearly 2 years now since Pepita went missing, and the circumstances around her disappearance are still unclear to law enforcement. But if you talk with her family, the clues are obvious. They said she was trying and struggling to leave this abusive relationship with Nicholas. The interactions with police were common, because I guess they were called a lot for domestic violence disputes. They said Nicholas had a controlling hand on how she communicated with family until that moment in March 2020 when they stopped hearing from her. And then there was settling silence. Shelda did say they just want answers and want to bring her home. And until then, Anita has said she struggled with not having her bright daughter around and was quoted saying she tries to keep herself strong by praying, by having faith, and that since Pepita went missing, her life has changed. So what I found interesting was, despite having the fifth largest indigenous population in the nation, the state of New Mexico has the highest number of missing and murdered indigenous women in the country. According to the Lilly, of the 92 missing person cases involving an American Indian or Alaska Native person, they have identified over a five-year period, only five have been solved. So advocates are hoping that New Mexico lawmakers will pass two bills that will allocate more resources towards finding missing indigenous people in the state and bridge gaps between law enforcement agencies. You know, Maggie, you mentioned this about, was it in Misty's case when you talked about there was how many?
There was less than 200 FBI agents assigned to federal cases and over 200 jurisdictions they were supposed to cover. So it's less than one agent per jurisdiction in the United States.
Yeah. So
it's like they could never catch up.
No.
But these cases are just
how far a lot of these places are. Like our closest FBI agency is probably in Asheville, right? So
I don't even know. I should probably know that. Yes.
It
is. I just looked it up.
So it probably, you know, like, it's not even localized. And I'm sure in bigger states and bigger areas, it's even worse.
Again, tribal courts have no jurisdiction over non-Native people. And when a Native American person goes missing on non-tribal land, you know, it's just this big thing between the jurisdictions and federal, you know,
federal and tribal and state.
I get that there's all these different kind of things, especially when you're dealing with like sovereign land and things like that. But, you know, when it comes to like the lives of people, there should be some cohesion there. And everybody should be working.
Yeah,
I agree.
So when Anita went to report her daughter missing to the Albuquerque Police Department, she said she had tried so hard to call the detective every day. But at the time, the COVID-19 pandemic was in its early weeks, and she said the police couldn't interview Pepita's boyfriend or other sources. She said the Navajo Nation government didn't offer her any resources, and local news stations declined to cover Pepita's case without police department approval.
But why could they not interview him? I mean, I understand the pandemic, I understand. But
without police Oh, you're talking about the
boyfriend.
I don't know. I know it's a pandemic.
I thought it was weird that they said that warrants weren't issued because of the pandemic. Like, I know, like, stuff did shut down for a while, especially with us, because, you know, we literally blocked off our entrances and exits to the trial reservation. But I'm sure most places, a lot of places didn't do that. But there was, I guess there was a shutdown.
It's hard to say. But, you know, I can imagine how frustrating that would be because,
well, it feels like this
pandemic
is
or not, this is my daughter. Yeah. And she's missing.
Crime is something that I feel like you would still do it regardless of a shutdown. Like, if someone gets murdered, you're not going to be like, oh,
this is the purge here.
We can't go in the office today.
Right.
There's still ways to interview someone.
I would think so. So she said that the pandemic delayed action on her sister's case, and it took months for police to start investigating and interviewing, and the case is still open. I found this quote from Jolene Holgate. She's the director for the Coalition to Stop Violence Against Native American Women. And she said, it's systemic racism. It's historical and intergenerational trauma that continues to perpetuate these stigmas that Black and brown people are just not as important as white people.
And we kind of talked about it in the last episode, too.
Yeah, well, I put here, like, you know, I referred back to Misty because we did have a really heavy discussion about
she was in that very movies with high-class movie stars and names that you know, and she still did not get the attention that she deserved.
She was in a movie with Meryl. We need to tag Meryl. We did have a pretty heavy discussion about how authorities just didn't take Misty's case seriously. And in reading this, I find that even with the evidence that the boyfriend was abusive, coupled with the fact that he was the last person to see her alive, how was his case possibly gone cold?
I hate that we say this a lot, but all of these cases have, like, the same structure. Abusive boyfriend, and it's always the same ending.
Mm-hmm.
No one cares. The cases are still open. Or they're closed with questionable, you know,
and they move
solutions,
on.
And then that's just, they're forgotten.
Have they interviewed him since?
Well, it says that Nicholas has maintained his innocence, but sources say he is not cooperating with the investigation.
So his story is that she just
left with another man. They got in a fight and she left with another man.
And that's the last time he's seen her.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if he really cared, he would be cooperating?
You would think so. Like, if you had nothing to hide, why would you not help?
And do you have a choice to be, like, uncooperative with police? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me.
And you could clear your name.
I'm not going to answer that question. Like, what?
No.
And you could clear your name.
True.
I mean, if you cooperate.
See, it makes sense to us. It makes sense when we talk about it. Pepita Redhair is 5'1", 141 pounds, with brown hair and brown eyes. She also has two beauty marks on her chin. In addition, she has a dinosaur tattoo on her right forearm and a koi fish on her left forearm, and a butterfly on one of her shoulders. If you have any information regarding the whereabouts of Pepita Redhair, please contact the Albuquerque Police Department at 505-242-2677. Hashtag justice for Pepita Redhair. Thank you for listening to We Are Resilient. For links to information found for this episode, you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at We Are Resilient Podcast. Send us an email at weareresilientpod@gmail.com or visit us at www.war-podcast.com.